Okay, so let's talk about the five aggregates this evening. Ultimate reality, the Buddha's higher teaching. Somewhat difficult to get your head around at first, but with repeated endeavour, it does pay the most incredible dividends because it's the most profound aspect of the Buddha's teaching, and the Buddha's teaching is profound enough. So I imagined that you came in for a meditation interview. And as often happens, you report what's going on in your meditation with the words, I get free of the hindrances and I'm just sitting there and nothing's happening. And that's often followed up with the inquiry as to, well, what do I do next? Well, firstly, it's very interesting when people reach that point and they say, there's nothing happening. Because, of course, to know there's nothing happening requires an awful lot of things to happen. But what it is we ignore it. We don't know what it is that's happening, and we certainly don't have the language to be able to describe, even to ourselves, what's happening. We're talking about peering into and looking at the processes of mind and body. And it is very easy for people to just be completely, blissfully unaware of all these processes that are going on. But it's to these processes that we must turn if it is the case that we truly want to realise the cessation of suffering. I will come on to this point in a person's training and what it is that needs to be looked at. But first, we have to just sort of go back a little bit in order to have the proper context to understand why it is that we'll be looking at what it is that we'll be looking at. A bit convoluted, but I hope we'll get there. So we have to go back to when the Buddha became enlightened. Gautama, Siddhartha Gautama, a real human being who lived in India 2,500 years ago, who, in a moment of incredible genius, decided to stop trying to find happiness. He decided to stop trying to find the cessation of suffering. And he decided instead just to look at what had always been going on under his nose the whole time that he'd always ignored. And it was at that point that he became enlightened. And what he did was that he described what he saw. And the whole of the Buddha's teaching is simply a description of reality. Yeah? And the goal of the Buddha's teaching, Nibbana, is simply the realization of the way life has always been. Now, Gautama's quest, the Buddha's quest, was to realize the cessation of suffering. And upon realizing the true nature of existence, he was therefore free of all suffering. Now, suffering is the stuff we all understand. It's all the things that we're only too aware of: depression, anxiety, fear, grief, and the rest. His enlightenment was the complete release from all forms of psychological suffering. And he was able to couch that entire description of reality, including what you have to do in order to get free of suffering, in what are called the Four Noble Truths. I'm sure most of you are fully aware of the Four Noble Truths, but they are the most concise explanation of his entire teaching. They are: the first noble truth is that there is suffering, that life is suffering. The second is that the cause of suffering is the passionate desire for life to be different than it is, which itself is based in ignoring the true nature of reality. The third is that there is indeed an entire cessation to suffering. It can be brought completely to an end, so there's no more depression, no more anxiety, no more existential crisis, whatever it happens to be for you. And the fourth noble truth, that there is indeed a way to realize the cessation of suffering. Yeah, and that way is what we call the Noble Eightfold Path. It's a description of reality, and it also offers a method of realizing the cessation of suffering, realizing the true nature of reality for oneself. If we look more closely at the First Noble Truth, his slightly expanded definition, what he meant by life is suffering, he said, birth is suffering, old age, decay and death is suffering, grief, sorrow, lamentation, pain and despair are suffering. To be united with the unloved is suffering. To be disunited from the loved is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. And he said, in short, the five groups subject to clinging are suffering. Now, this is a very important distinction. This last clause, he says, in short, the five groups subject to clinging are suffering. Now here he is explicitly, although very concisely, explaining ultimate reality. All the other clauses relate to what we call conventional reality, which is the reality that everyone is typically familiar with, that there are people who live on planet Earth, who go about their business, and in the course of going about their business, they suffer grief, sorrow, lamentation, pain and despair because they're disunited from the things they love, united with the things that they do not love and can't get what they want. So implied in that is that there is a world which is potentially satisfying, which contains objects which should, in theory, give us lasting happiness, and there is, in amongst it, a me walking about separate from all these other me's. So it's very much the conventional reality, and he's describing that as being suffering. In the last clause, he's talking about these five groups subject to clinging. These are the five aggregates, and he is explaining ultimate reality. We can discern from this that the Buddha's teaching contains two different interpretations of reality: conventional or mundane reality and what we call ultimate reality. And this confuses some people because they think, well, how can you have two realities? Surely everything is one. Hopefully we'll come on to that. But it is entirely possible to have more than one way of defining reality. You can have as many ways of defining reality as you like. But the way you define reality will have an effect on how you experience it. If you were to walk down a street, a high street, a shopping district with an architect, he would be able to give you an interpretation of reality based on his knowledge of architecture, wouldn't he? If you walk down the same high street with a sociologist, the sociologist would be able to give you an interpretation of reality based on their understanding. Which is the right one? Is one of them right and one of them wrong? No, they're both right. Of course, because they're relative. It's relative to the sphere of knowledge that they've become skilled in. So, in the same way, we can have more than one way of defining reality. Now, the Buddha is defining exactly the same reality, this reality, the only reality there actually is, into distinct and separate ways. The one way, the conventional way, is the way most people understand it, and it's the way most spiritual ways deal with. So most spiritual ways will deal with, how can I be happier? How can I be more at peace in the conventional world? The Buddha's teaching most definitely covers this. It suggests that our actions have results, that it's a very good idea to behave with that in mind and learn from experience which are the ways that produce the happy results and which are the ways that produce the painful results, and make intelligent choices based on your discoveries. So keeping precepts, being generous, being kind, practicing loving kindness, being helpful to people generally, will make your life more enjoyable. It also includes, of course, the notion of what comes after the breakup of this physical body, what some people call death. So it's a very comprehensive, mundane teaching, in common with a lot of spiritual ways. It really isn't, doesn't really kind of in that way stand out. All spiritual ways have, if they're genuine spiritual ways, talk of being friendly and kind and helpful, and you will be better off personally as a consequence. What the Buddha brought in addition to that is this teaching, this higher teaching on the ultimates. It is through training in the higher teaching that we can come to realize the complete cessation of suffering. But it's important to realize that it is looking at the same reality, but just through a different lens, just using a different schema, just using a different set of references. Has anyone seen the film Arrival? Oh, there's so many no's. Oh, do get it out, it's brilliant. Is anyone concerned about plot spoilers, particularly? It's a wonderful film. It's about aliens coming to visit. They just want a they're not here to blow us up or anything, they just want a favour. And of course, human beings are very sceptical. And so they get a linguist to learn the aliens' language. And it's a very different, obviously a very different kind of language. Doesn't sound much of a plot, does it? But it is a lovely film. One of the themes in the film is based on a hypothesis. I did memorise what the name of the hypothesis is. Now I can't recall it. It's something like the Sepa-Whorf hypothesis, something along those lines. And basically, all it's saying is, essentially what it's saying is that the language that you use has an effect on the way that you perceive and categorise and experience your reality. So in the film, what happens is the linguist, Amy Adams, very good actress, her character is changed in a profound and very unexpected way through learning this language. So she starts to perceive life differently because she's learning the language of an alien species. It's a very clever film. It's very good. I do recommend it. Obviously, entirely unsatisfactory, ultimately. But anyway. So the same thing happens when we begin to introduce, well, not the same thing, obviously not the same thing, but a similar thing happens in terms of our perception of the world will be changed through learning ultimate reality, through learning the language of ultimate reality. And the five aggregates are a major part, five aggregates along with an understanding of conditionality is the language of ultimate reality and the language that you need to use. When you reach that point, to where I started, when you reach that point in the meditation, when you're going, but there's nothing going on, that's the point at which you really need to be learning and gaining an intellectual understanding of ultimate reality, because it's that then is the next thing you need to be doing. And that this really is the unique aspect of the Buddha's teaching. I don't know of any other spiritual path that is so clear in being able to define ultimate reality as distinct from conventional reality. As far as I can see in other spiritual ways, there's a kind of, it's all melded together and it's never really clearly established what the difference is. Some study is required. I put a list of the five aggregates as an appendix in my book, also an appendix of condition-dependent origination. There is a very long explanation to be found in the Visuddhimagga, which is a classical book of Theravada Buddhism, which will be in the library. I absolutely adore a volume called Comprehensive Manual of Abhidhamma, also be found in the library, which is, do you remember the old Haynes manuals for cars? It's like that for Ultimate Reality. It's like something an engineer would come up with. It's just an absolutely fantastic, concise distillation of how Ultimate Reality all fits together. So there are places you can go to get a detailed exposition on all of this. Obviously, in the time available, we can only go lightly over the surface of it. The Five Aggregates is a complete description of everything you'll find in this moment at the ultimate level. So let me describe them, what they are for you. Materiality is the first. Feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. So there's one aggregate relating to matter and four relating to mind. Materiality, the aggregate, I should explain the word aggregate. Aggregate means heap. When in meditation you become aware of materiality, say in the form of sound, that belongs to the heap, the aggregate of materiality. Now there isn't a physical heap, obviously. It's metaphorical in that sense. But when you note materiality, you know that it belongs to the group. It belongs to the heap, belongs to the aggregate of materiality. So what does that contain? It contains all things which are material in nature. Shape and colour ultimately does exist. If you can see, then you're aware of shape and colour. Are you aware of shape and colour? Can I just check everyone's aware of shape and colour? Okay. Sound ultimately exists. It does happen. Is everyone aware of sound? So sound is happening. Smell? Alright, I won't ask too many questions about smell, but smelling does occur. It ultimately does exist, doesn't it? Taste. Obviously, probably not too much taste going on right now, but we're all aware that taste does happen. It does exist. And tactile sensations in the form of hardness, softness, of temperature, of pressure, those unique moments of tactile sensation do occur, don't they? They do happen. They do exist. So also included in the aggregate of materiality will be the sensitivity of the senses which register those objects. So the sensitivity of what we call the eye base, which receives the light by which we are able to discern shape and colour. The ear, the sensitive matter of the ear that picks up the air vibrating, which gives us sound. So it includes the five physical sense bases as well as the objects. It includes other things as well, such as bodily intimation. That's bodily intimation. I could do other things, but no, let's keep it. And vocal intimation, obviously, which is going on as well. Yeah, that's enough to be getting on with. But we kind of understand the sort of thing. Full lists are available. I'm not intending to go through the full list. The other four aggregates are all to do with mind. Feeling. In the books, feeling is stated to be that aspect of consciousness which experiences the flavour of the object. So is the flavour can either be pleasant, unpleasant or neutral. So you might hear a sound, or we're talking ultimately here, there is a sound and there is a painful feeling that arises with the sound, or there is a pleasant feeling that arises with the sound, or there's a neutral feeling. So that's what the feeling component is. And feelings actually happen. There are feelings. Perception is another aggregate. A perception is the way the mind labels the experience. So, yeah, a very good example is on the workshop on Saturday, we're doing the first guided meditation, and I heard the sound of a fly. So ultimately speaking, there was a sound, neutral feeling, and perception arose, fly. After the meditation, I asked the people who were in the workshop, did you hear the fly? And they said it was a wasp. And we looked and it was indeed a wasp. So one of the people on the course had experienced sound, had experienced a perception wasp, and experienced a painful feeling, because it was perceived differently, more accurately. I'd got it down to a little insect with wings, but after that I got a bit confused. So the point being that perception has a role to play. Ultimately, a perception does happen. It occurs, it labels an experience so that we can have an understanding of what's going on around us. Mental formations. Mental formations is a very big net of different mental qualities. It includes all, say, the hindrances, worry, hatred, sensual desire, and so forth. It includes all the positive mental qualities like tranquility, happiness, contentment, faith. It also includes some subtle aspects of mind that go to make up our experience, like contact, concentration, one-pointedness, and so forth. A big bag of mental qualities that go to make up experience. But they all happen. They all actually exist, albeit momentarily. The last aggregate is consciousness itself. Consciousness is a very, very simple... It's not... They call consciousness the hard problem. The hard problem of consciousness is... No, it's quite simple. It's seeing. It's knowing an object. It's the knowing of an object. So it's seeing, it's hearing, it's tasting, it's touching, it's smelling. I am going quickly over this because we don't want to get too deeply into the detail. It wouldn't work as a talk. So we'll lightly go over the aggregates. But whenever you actually consider your momentary experience and you're breaking it down into deconstructing it and looking at what is actually there, whatever it is that you discern, whatever it is that you label in your experience will belong to one of those five aggregates. And there is nothing outside of it. Nothing outside of those five that occurs. Now you'll be going, yeah, but Paul, what about wasps? I know that was on your mind. Well, let's explain that. Let's go through that experience and why it is that ultimately the wasp did not exist. Conventionally, of course, but ultimately there was no wasp. If we look at it in ultimate terms, that experience, so the eyes were closed, so there was no shape and colour. The eye base was not in operation. There was no seeing. It did not exist. There was, however, sound. That did exist because there was an ear, the sensitive matter of the ear to hear the sound. So hearing, consciousness, did take place. Now, for one person, the perception arose erroneously, fly. And what came with it was a neutral feeling, but there was a thought, so mental formations, there was a thought, I wonder if it will sit on my nose. Now, having subsequently found out it was actually a wasp, sort of glad it didn't really, but it wouldn't have mattered because all that person would have been aware of was a sensation, a tactile sensation, but it didn't happen, but were it to happen, there would simply be the tactile sensation of pressure. Right? Have you ever been in a meditation and thought there was something crawling? Yeah. And then after the meditation you realised there wasn't anything there at all. Because there was a tactile sensation that did exist. Creepy crawly was simply the content of your thinking. There was a perception, there is something crawling, but that was believed and that became a narrative and a story. Just as for me, there was a story that there is a fly, not in the ointment, in the room when I'm trying to do a guided meditation. Do you know how awkward that is? Very awkward. It was louder than me. I thought, I'm going to have to actually talk louder. As it transpired, it was actually a wasp. All right, So I'm trying to explain why there's no wasp in ultimate reality. There is simply the label, ultimately. And what is happening is that these five aggregates are being weaved together. And as part of that weaving together, a narrative is created in order to make sense of this amorphous mass of information. So the mind is a natural component, creates a narrative to make sense of what's going on. The fly exists only within that narrative. It doesn't exist actually. There was just simply, at that moment, there was a moment of sound, there was hearing, there was a feeling, there was perception. So there was materiality, there was consciousness, there was mental formations. Yeah, there was perception, there was feeling. But it's only in the conventional reality, within that narrative, that we have created the idea of a fly or a wasp. If you open your eyes and look at it, you say, yeah, but Paul, there's a fly. No, there's a wasp there. See, I'm getting confused now. But actually, it still applies. All that's happened is that you now there is now shape and colour. Yellow, black. Danger, perception, and there is still the application of the perception, the label, wasp. Right? It takes quite a while to get your head around this. So on the one hand, and it requires your interest, it requires your desire to find out about this yourself. It's very easy to dismiss as blah. But you can go on suffering as long as you like. But if somebody really wants to realise the cessation of suffering, you really have to look at this closely. I'm not going to dwell on it, but what I'm going to talk about now is this weaving process, this weaving together of the aggregates. This is what we mean by conditionality. And you also have to understand conditionality. These aggregates do not exist in isolation. They only exist because there are other aggregates arising which brings that particular aggregate into being. The best way I have found to describe conditionality in a way that is understandable quickly is to describe a rainbow. Does a rainbow have any intrinsic existence separate from the rest of the world? Does a rainbow hide behind hills and when it rains and the sun shines thinks, oh, here's my chance, and sort of leaps out from behind the hill and goes, right. And then when the sun goes back in, it sort of leaps back behind the hill so it can't be seen. Does a rainbow exist? It's just the outcome of conditions, isn't it? I can't get too deeply into the physics because I'm not that clever. But as I understand it, it's just simply that light is being reflected in the moist atmosphere, and it creates this effect. The rainbow doesn't have any separate existence, does it? It's just the outcome of conditions. That is the best example I've come across to explain conditionality. One thing does not exist in isolation. It all comes as a piece. And so, therefore, in addition to understanding each of the aggregates, you have to understand also that that moment of sound is as real as a rainbow. That moment of shape and colour is as real as a rainbow. That thought arising in the mind is as real as a rainbow. The Buddha described the aggregates as like being like a conjurer's trick, as being like a mirage. Yeah, it's being like a rainbow. It appears as though there's this solid, discrete world that can be relied upon for your happiness. But when you really start to look carefully using the tools that the Buddha's given us, You come to see for yourself by applying this description of reality and looking closely at it, that that conventional reality just simply doesn't hold up. It continues, it carries on, but it doesn't ultimately stand up as being absolutely real. It's all like a rainbow. The point is, if you've learned how to rest content in the moment, if you've learned how to be without desperately trying to make life different than it is in the moment, the next stage of the meditation is to apply yourself to noting these ultimates of experience again and again and again, and actually gaining insight, seeing through the appearance of things and looking directly at what is actually taking place. Because that will resolve the problem of suffering. How? You can only passionately crave for life to be different than it is if you ignore the true nature of existence. And the more you see that there is nothing substantial to cling to, the clinging falls away, the craving falls away. And you recognize that there is this underlying non-dependent happiness, which is not something that's created, but it is what's left when you are no longer passionately desiring life to be different than it is, and when you're no longer ignoring the true nature of reality. So it is really important to gain a proper intellectual understanding of what those five aggregates are, and a proper intellectual understanding of conditionality. But then not resting with that, but then applying what you have learned, the language that you've learned, applying it to your meditative experience whenever you're free from craving for life to be different than it is. And it's through that process that you come to see the true nature of reality, and the craving falls away.